Sairam, dear listeners, welcome to this week's Radio Sai Answering Booth. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai. And before all else, let's offer our most humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Let me begin today with a small flashback. Today is the 15th of December. Yesterday was a day of sweet memories, because it was the 14th of December way back in 1945 that Swami entered his first mandir. Of course, now we refer to it as Patha Mandir or Old Mandir, but back then it was Swami's very first Mandir. After Swami had declared his avatar and his mother had extracted a promise that he will not leave Puttaparthi, Swami initially stayed at his home for a short while. He then shifted to the house of Karnam Subbamma. But seeing the trouble this devotee had to undergo on account of the endless stream of devotees, and more so the hostility and criticism she had to face from the villagers, Swami would spend a lot of time in some caves in the hills and hillocks around. Seeing Swami struggle this way, Subbamma decided to build a small mandir for Swami in the outskirts of the village. That pious devotee, who was one of the first ones to offer Swami a place in the temple of her own heart, now gave Swami a place to build a small temple for himself. Sadly though, she did not live to see Swami enter this mandir. But Swami did fulfill her wish when on December the 14th, the Vaikuntha Ekadashi day of that year, Swami entered this small mandir, which was to witness unimaginable leelas of Swami. Well, I guess we'll spend enough time in nostalgia. Better we get on with the program. After all, this is the answering booth and we have questions to answer, don't we? But as always, before the questions come the quote of the week. So here it comes, and this is a quote from Henry David Thoreau, American thinker and philosopher. I quote, "As a single footstep will not make a path on earth, so a single thought will not make a pathway in the mind. To make a deep physical path, we walk again and again. To make a deep mental path, we must think over and over again the kind of thoughts we wish to dominate our lives." End of quote. Well, that quote is really good, because that is something Swami would so often tell us too. Thoughts are very, very powerful, and Swami would say the whole creation is based on our thoughts. Thoughts look so insignificant, but when that thought takes root, it can make or even break us. I recall an interaction that happened between Swami and a few youngsters once. These boys were very active when it came to seva, but wisdom or the thought that we are essentially divine was not their cup of tea. So they asked Swami, "Swami, you keep telling us you are all divine, you are also God. But why are we not able to realize it? How do we really get there?" And Swami replied, "Just like how Swami keeps reiterating, you too keep reiterating it in your mind. Keep thinking I'm divine, you will reach there one day." That's what Swami said. As all our actions and words are born from thoughts, eventually actions and words, our actions and all our words will align themselves with these thoughts. Another understanding that we can draw from that quote is, one thought does not define us. Especially youngsters do this mistake. They are given to enormous amount of guilt on account of a few bad thoughts or feelings. We must remember that even that is only a stray thought. Just as a noble thought has to be thought over and over again to make an impact, even an unpleasant or bad thought takes root only when we think of it repeatedly. If you feel you've entertained such a thought, immediately counter it with a flood of good thoughts and feelings. Don't entertain bad thoughts, but don't give too much importance to bad thoughts by worrying endlessly about them too. So let me read that quote of Henry David Thoreau one more time before we head to the questions. "As a single footstep will not make a path on earth, so a single thought will not make a pathway in the mind. To make a deep physical path, we walk again and again. To make a deep mental path, we must think over and over the kind of thoughts we wish to dominate our lives." Let's then head to the questions then. The first question is from Brother Ankush Nair. I don't know from where he's writing to us. I'll be reading out the question. I'm sure you'll find this question an interesting one. So here's the question from Brother Ankush Nair. "I would like to post this question for Radio Sai Answering Booth. Kindly throw some light on it. Can God control our mind? If yes, when a person is doing wrong things, why is he not controlling it? Why does he wait and watch whether we are going to do the right thing or not, then reward us if we do good and punish us if we choose to do wrong? If God is the supreme being, he then must be knowing in advance what I'm going to do. Or he doesn't have the power to know our future, what a human being will do? I'm writing this question in a lot of pain due to happenings around that seem to be wrong, and being on the right path, I often get this question. They say nothing happens without God's will. Then how can God will unjust for some and just for some, as he does not seem to have any bias? We rely completely on him, and some situations shake our faith in him if it happens over and over again. How do we reinstall faith in God? Well, that's the question. Thank you, Brother Ankush, for your question, or rather questions. I will start by giving straight answers to few of the questions that you've asked, and maybe explain as we get to the more complex ones. Can God control our minds? Yes, of course. Then why does he not control the minds of men when they are about to do something evil? The answer is, he chooses not to. Just because he doesn't interfere in control does not necessarily mean that God cannot, but he chooses not to. But why does he choose not to? We'll come to that later. The other question that you raise is, God being the supreme being, must know in advance what one will do. Does he really know? If he knows, why does he not take any preemptive action? That's a very logical question to ask, right? Say I'm driving a car and I see a huge truck driving towards me. My logical mind will calculate that if I keep driving in the same speed without changing course and he keeps driving in the same speed without changing course, then there will be a collision. So either I slow down or move to the side. So I'm using my ability to foresee the future to stop an impending disaster. Of course, in this case, it is logic and reason. In God's case, we expect omniscience to work, right? In the later part, you ask, how can God will unjust for some and justice for some others? Well, I think this question reveals the paradox, or rather the confusion in our approach. I'm not, of course, accusing you, Brother Ankush. I'm saying this in general. We all tend to have this confusion. Let me start with that question of God being biased. Let me give you this example. Let's say there's a teacher in a class, and let's say she's a very sincere one at that. She teaches all her lessons very well, does not waste time, and also ensures that she gives attention to every student in the class. Any student can walk up to her and ask doubts. She is more than willing to help. She gives homework to the whole class so that the children can go back and learn their lessons at home too. However, however good a teacher she may be, she limits herself to her classes and keeps her interaction with the students confined to the school. Okay? She chooses not to interfere with the student's life outside the school, let's say. Now the exam season comes, she prepares a common test paper for the entire class based on what she has taught them. She herself invigilates and also later corrects the exam papers. And purely based on the answers written, she marks the students. Some students pass, some fail. Would you call her a biased teacher or an unbiased teacher? Will you call her biased simply because some students in her class have failed while others haven't? Same is the case with God, isn't it? We all are attending the same class. The lessons taught to us are the same. The test we will face will also be the same. If I fail because I haven't learned the lessons or followed the instructions, how can I call God unfair or biased? What will make God unfair is if he chooses to interfere. Let's say the teacher, while invigilating, looks over the shoulder of one of the students and sees that he is writing the wrong answer. Well, she knows he is wrong. She knows that when the results come, he would have even failed. But do you think it would be fair for the teacher to correct the student at that time? Or will she be a good teacher if she allows him to make the mistake, lose the marks, or maybe even fail the test, and have him go through the test again and learn the lesson? I'm sure you will agree, even though the teacher knows, she will choose not to interfere if she is a straightforward teacher. So do you see the contradiction in the two questions you've raised? If God were to control our minds before we do wrong, it is then that he would be failing his duty and would become unjust. Allowing the actions and reaction cycle to take its course is the just approach. You might ask, so what about those who get hurt when a bad person is allowed to do the mistake? Take the example of a robber. When God allows him to rob, instead of transforming his mind and stopping him, doesn't another person get harmed in the process? That's why it is important to remember that God is always just and has no biases. If a person is being robbed, he most certainly needs to go through that experience, either because he himself has harmed someone and has to get it back, or there is something to be learned through that experience, and God is putting him through that. So I hope you see one of the mistakes we do when we are trying to understand the working of the system. On one hand, we say God is just and unbiased. On the other hand, we say, how can God be so unkind as to see us do mistakes and get punished for it? For God to be unbiased, he must allow the system to work perfectly, unhindered. Let me come to the question that the other question that you raised, which troubles most people, especially God-loving people and in general, good people. We say nothing happens without God's will, and God is all-loving. Then why do people suffer? What we do when we ask a question like this is, we take a factor which is the overbearing truth and connect it to a single event happening under the whole umbrella of the system and try to ask for a logical explanation. I know that would have made no sense at all, so let me explain that with an example. You know, a lot of people make fun of trying to explain spirituality through analogies, but it is so very effective that using analogies to explain is indispensable in explaining spiritual concepts. In fact, this approach is called Upamana Pramana in the Vedas, explaining through comparisons and analogies. Okay, let me get back to the example I was about to give you. Well, now in India, we have a legal system, right? There are clear laws that say what are the offenses that are punishable, what are the sentences that will be handed out for what crimes and so on. Now, this legal system is ruled by the Indian Constitution, right? That is the real governing document of this legal system. Now, who has created this constitution? We had a drafting committee that did it, and it was headed by none other than Dr. Ambedkar. So this drafting committee made up of a few very honorable men of the country have created this constitution that decides the legal framework of this entire country. Now, let us say there is a man who is arrested for a crime that he has done and is sentenced to life imprisonment. Because he is jailed, his family is plunged into poverty. Now, if I were to say, how heartless is this Dr. Ambedkar and others, because of them, today a family is suffering in poverty. Are these gentlemen responsible for the condition of this family? Well, in a sense, yes, because it is they who have created this entire legal system. But are they cruel and morally responsible for the suffering of the family? No, they are not. They are only creators of this legal system. But now it is up to the citizens to act within this framework and take responsibility for their actions, good or bad. So now do you understand what I meant when I said we take a factor which is the overbearing truth and connect it to a single event happening under the whole umbrella of the system and try to ask for a logical explanation? In the same manner, when we say everything happens by God's will, yes, this entire system of action and reaction has been ordained by God. There is no doubt about that. In that sense, all of this punishment and reward is his will. But after creating this system, he has allowed it to operate without interference. Well, he does interfere, but I'll come to that in a bit. But for now, this is how it is. He has created the system, laid out clearly what is right and wrong, punishable and rewardable, what will be the punishment and what will be the reward. Now it is for us to choose and do and take responsibility for what we choose to do. There are two doubts that may arise based on what I've just said. One is, does that mean we have the free will? Do we have the freedom to choose, or is everything already predestined? That will lead to the classic debate between God's will and individual will. I was really tempted to go into that in reply to this question, but that'll take the focus away from the discussion. To explain that concept, we will have to necessarily speak about the Advaita philosophy. Maybe some other time in response to some other appropriate question, I will speak about that. For now, take it that God has created us and has given each individual the ability to make choices. And after giving us the ability to choose and act, he does not interfere. In that sense, God plays the role of the eternal witness. But as I said, there is an exception which we will come to shortly. The second issue you might have with the example I gave of the legal system is, but don't we have innocent people suffering? Don't we have culprits hoodwinking the law? Why should an innocent family suffer for the man's crime? My explanation to that would be the analogy that I gave is limited like any other analogy one gives. When we are talking about God's system, it is a perfect system. As Swami would say in a Padyam, counting to the last penny, you get what you deserve. Good for good and bad for bad. And in God's plan, if you are undergoing anything apparently you do not deserve, that too is because of things you might have done at some time in the past. Why should we be punished for acts we don't have memory of? Well, I had explained that a few episodes ago, so I'll not go into that again. Now to the point of, does God interfere in the system at all? Yes, He does. And that is where the concept of devotion and grace come in. At any point, if anyone in this system of action and reaction turns to God and earns His favor, he or she can find a means of breaking this vicious cycle. But before I explain that further, what is this system meant to do to us? Okay, we get good for good and bad for bad, but what should this system lead us to? Well, I love telling this story. Once a simple man goes to a guru and asks him, "Master, I keep going through life. Sometimes there is happiness, sometimes there is pain. Sometimes success, sometimes failure. Sometimes life is fair, sometimes unfair. What is the purpose of this whole drama?" The master looks at him, smiles and tells, "This is the purpose." "This is the purpose? What does that even mean?" Then the master says, "The purpose is that one day you will ask, what is the purpose of this whole thing?" What the story suggests is, the whole idea is to make us take to what we call in Sanskrit as vichara or inquiry. To ask deeper questions. Not just go after pleasures and avoid pain, but to pause and ask this important question, what's the whole point? And depending on each of our natures, we can choose a path. Some of us become philosophical and inquire into what is pain, are we really the body, who suffers, who enjoys, and so on. This will take us through the path of jnana or wisdom. Or we may turn to God with the belief, all this makes no sense to me, only God is real, and eventually end up developing devotion and surrender. Of course, this does not happen at the end of life, but it is an ongoing process. But the problem with us is, we ask such questions when in pain, like Brother Ankush, you have asked. You say in your question itself how pained you are. But most of us forget about these questions and conclusions once life returns to normalcy. That's why Swami would say, Mother Kunti prayed to Krishna that give me only problems, because that is when I tend to think of you more. But if we can always keep such vichara going on, or are able to hold on to this truth that this life will not give me joy, only God can, even when life is going smooth, I don't think we need to pray for difficulties in life. But remember, there is no escape from doing good deeds, leading a life of not harming others, because it is that goodness which will eventually lead one to vichara. Well, you may then ask, so when I turn to God and God helps me out with His grace, will it not be a case of God circumventing His own system? Wouldn't it be like the student has pleased the teacher and she is helping him in the exam? This is where we must remember two points. God cannot be pleased with praises and gifts, and in life, exams are integrated into the learning process itself, something like a CIE, a constant integrated evaluation. God is pleased only with goodness. Goodness and God cannot be separated ever. So when I say you start pleasing God, it only means, instead of going through this mechanism and eventually becoming good, you become good to please Swami. And your love for God will make you turn to goodness and hold on to this path more firmly. When that is the whole idea, why will God have a problem in showering His grace on you and help you with your tests? And remember, I explained in that example that teacher is very kind and ever ready to help you understand the lessons. Her love in that example expresses as patience. Similarly, God is ever ready to help, but we must turn to Him and seek Him for that. The first question you asked was, can God control our minds, right? Yes, God can, but for that, we must want Him to control our minds. If I wish to be good and my past vasanas or tendencies are preventing me, if I sincerely pray to God to transform my mind, He will. But otherwise, though He can, He chooses not to. And once we surrender to God, He not only helps us learn the lessons we are meant to learn, but will also ease the process of learning itself. And that is what is referred to as God's grace. So in summary, all I would say is, believe that God plays both roles of a witness and an active mentor. It is up to us what we choose. But the mistake we do is, most of the time we want good results for our good actions. When things go wrong, we turn to God, the mentor, and ask, why are you just a mere witness? If you have accepted God to be the active ruler of your destiny, then believe that nothing unfair can ever happen to you. Accept whatever comes to you as actively chosen for you by God. Accept it as prasadam, blessings. And always remember, as much as God is all love, God is all justice too. And what we generally do in understanding God through individual events is a statistical error called errors due to small or insufficient sample size. We take a few stray incidents in life and question the love and compassion of God. We cannot understand His nature through such a small sample size. As the sample size under study increases, the error in the result reduces. So don't come to conclusions, but wait patiently and observe. You will see that God's wisdom is far superior, and even more superior is God's compassion. Finally, God is not only prepared to interfere in our lives, but is waiting to interfere and transform our minds. Maybe I'll conclude with one of my favorite conversations between Swami and a few students. Once when Swami was in the interview dome, Swami materialized a huge diamond. Swami asked the students, what is the message I give about diamonds? One of the students said, Swami, die mind. Swami said, yes, you must put an end to your mind. Immediately one of the boys quipped, Swami, you should kill our minds for us. And Swami replied, yes, I will, but you must first give me your minds for that. So can Swami transform the mind? Yes, but we must be prepared to turn to God and give Him our mind for that. So thank you, Brother Ankush, for your question. If my answer has raised more doubts in you, do write to me again. I would be glad to address them as well. The next question is from a sister somewhere in India, I guess. I will refrain from revealing her name. I have our volunteer sister Sumana reading out the question. Well, after we listen to the question, we'll answer this young listener.
I feel really anxious in some situations, and sometimes even start shaking. At times, I don't even feel like doing anything. Is it depression? My interest in life is getting lesser and lesser day after day. I just don't like doing anything. And then I really feel dissatisfied that I am not contributing anything. I have completed my master's in 2015 and now I am at home. My parents are looking for an alliance. Generally, girls feel so happy and excited for this, as you are considered most important and all keep thinking for your future life. I do wish to work, but at this time, I don't know where my parents will get me married. If I were to find a job, by the time I settle, I might have to get ready for marriage with a suitable alliance. I will then have to leave the job depending on my parents or his parents' wish. That will push me further low, so I don't want to take up anything new until my marriage is fixed and over. I used to have interest in painting, and very surprisingly, I am no more interested in it either. I keep getting so irritated with my mother also when she wants me to learn certain things before marriage. Actually, my parents are very loving to me. They have not stopped me from taking up a job. But as they are seriously looking out for a match for me, I don't wish to cause any difficulties to them or to myself. Please help.
Thank you, sister, for your question. So let me give you a straight answer. No, it's not a depression. You don't have to worry about that. Yours is more a case of excitement and nervousness to an extent. You are on the threshold of a new beginning, so that uncertainty as to what will come about and how things will pan out in the future is all that is causing you to be in a state of excitement. You might wonder how I'm saying this is excitement when you are saying that though your parents are looking out for matches for you, you feel lack of joy. Excitement need not necessarily be joyous all the time. It can also be caused by a slight panic inside. If you speak to some of your elders, they will tell you that this is quite a common thing that happens in this phase of life. Of course, there is a little difference in your case, as I can see from what you have mentioned in your question, but we'll come to that in a bit. And in the state of mind, the usual things which give you joy, which interest you, will appear to not excite you. But nothing to worry. This will last only for a brief period till you settle down in your new life. But of course, there are some things that you can do right now to calm yourself. I'll explain a few things you can do. Also, these tips will help you in life in general too. From what you have said in your question, you're not exactly opposed to the idea of marriage, right? But certainly you are interested in a career too. But there is a certain amount of uncertainty whether or not you will be able to work after marriage. And this is causing two problems. One is, starting on a new job now appears meaningless as you are not sure if you will be able to continue. And the other issue is, there is a possibility that you may not get an opportunity to pursue a career after marriage. And that is making you feel that you will be entering into an unproductive life if that were to happen. Let me start with the first issue. If you feel like taking up a job and your parents have no objection to it, do take up a job. Don't worry about what will happen after marriage and so on. One thing, it will keep your mind occupied. And secondly, it will not make you feel that you are not contributing or you are unproductive. See, not every job has to lead to a lifelong career. You say you graduated in 2015 with master's, which means at least 17 to 18 years of your life so far has been spent in education, right? You were not earning all that while. In other words, you were not monetizing your time. But why is it that you did not feel you are unproductive all these years? It is because you believed that you were learning, and that learning is adding value to you. But now, after you have completed your education, you feel it is your duty to contribute to your family and maybe even the society. There's nothing wrong in that. In fact, it is very good and correct that you have this thought. But there is one mistake we tend to do in this stage. We think that learning is over and earning should begin. So we tend to assign value to our time only on the basis of how much money our time can be converted into now. We must remember that the process of learning is ongoing, and sometimes in life, if not anything, we will continue to learn through our experiences. And when you keep this always in mind, just like how you didn't feel your education was a period of no contribution, you will see every experience in life as valuable as long as it provides some learning. I remember one very valuable lesson I learned when I was doing my master's. My lecturer had given me an experiment for my MSc project, and basically it was about synthesizing an organic compound. Under his guidance, I worked on it for well over 4 months, and at the end of it, we did not get the desired results. When the time came to write the, what we call the project report, I asked him, a little dejected, I said, "Sir, what is the point in writing a report? After all, our experiments have failed." It was then that he told me that, "See, in science, there are no failures. Maybe you did not synthesize the compound you wanted, but from the view of science, you have shown that this method does not work, which is as valuable as saying that this method works. So what is a failed experiment in your view is also equally valuable because it has taught you something." Well, I think this holds good for life too. The problem with us is we always have some goal or result in mind when we take up anything. A master's degree should give me such and such a job. When I take up a job, that should result in a career in that direction, and so on. in the process, we attach too much importance to that goal and fail to acknowledge the value of the process itself. So as a fundamental change to the way you look at things, approach every experience as a means to learn something more. Maybe as an extension from that point, I can suggest two more things that you can do apart from taking up a job now. You could either go for some classes, maybe even cooking classes, as I'm sure that must be one of the things your mother is trying to teach you. It will keep your mind occupied, and what you learn will be handy whether or not you take up a career after your marriage. But what would be more ideal is if you could keep yourself busy with some sort of service or seva. See, if you're feeling that you're not contributing anything, there is no other activity which will fill that vacuum better than offering service somewhere without accepting any remuneration. It could be anything. Again, it need not be some activity you should be able to continue after your marriage. And believe me, this will help you after marriage too. Because this idea that you will not be able to contribute or you are not contributing much comes from a few deep-rooted ideas. So let me try and explain this a little bit more. Why is it that you are feeling that you are not contributing enough or you feel a certain restlessness? As I said, in your particular case, it's a point of time where you are at the threshold of a new beginning, which is keeping you a bit preoccupied with these thoughts. And because of that, you're not able to do anything much more productive, and your temper flares are just a result of all of this. But something which is very basic in all of this is, as long as we don't use our time for others, we will not feel it as time well spent. For us to feel satisfaction, for us to feel that we have used time well, for that matter, even life well, we must have used our time not for ourselves, but for others. And when I say others, if not the society at large, at least for those in your own family. Nowadays, they spread this idea that people, especially women, spend all their life for others and they don't live for themselves. It is so unfair. People should learn to live for themselves and so on. Well, in my opinion, it's totally absurd. Time is worthwhile only when it is spent for others. Our time should be valuable for more people than just ourselves. Yes, personal space, self-care, all of that is important, but it plays a very small role in life. A simple example: tomorrow you go for a movie with your friends and come. The day after, you spend the same 3 hours teaching lessons to, let's say, your maid's child. Compare what you feel about the 3 hours you spent, the 2-3 hours that you spent. On the day you help that kid with his or her lessons, you will feel, today's day was very well spent. So we will feel time is well spent when it is useful to more people than just ourselves. Okay, now one way of making our time useful is to take up a job and earn and add to the family's income. You could do that now and after your marriage too. I would call this a tangible contribution. You can quantify your contribution, right? But many times in life, we should be ready to do such work, which will definitely add value to the life of others around us, but our contribution will be so intangible that it may even go unnoticed. Many of us are not ready to make such contribution. In fact, traditionally, women are ones who do more of such actions because such actions call for enormous amounts of selflessness and patience, which it is believed women naturally have. So even as you are preparing yourself for this new phase in life, keep this in mind. Don't measure the success of your life and the worth of your time purely on the basis of the tangible contributions you make to your family. If you make this a part of your understanding now, the uncertainty of whether you will work or not work after marriage will not trouble you as much. Because you know for sure that whatever is the case, you will be a contributor. In fact, you will be a greater contributor if you choose not to work. I'll come to that part in a bit. So what I'm saying is you will fill yourself with the confidence that you will make your life worthwhile, whatever be the case, job or no job. Now, I'm not saying don't take up a job after marriage. I think that should depend totally on the needs of that time. But when you have these concepts sorted out in your mind, you will not create imaginary needs, as Swami says, and only if it is really necessary, you'll think about a career after marriage. You might feel, I have done a master's degree, how can I not take up a job? Wouldn't that be a waste of the resources invested in my education? I'll give you a different argument for that. Let's say I'm doing a certain work which I'm qualified for. So I'm making good use of my qualifications, right? Let's say I have a qualification and there are a set of jobs I can take up. Among those jobs, there is one job which no one else can do but me. And if I take up that job, I become irreplaceable. Going back to the definition of how we can make our lives worthwhile, it is when we use it for others. Now there is this job which only I can do. Does that not make my life infinitely valuable when I spend it to do that particular job? I hope you're getting my logic. Same will be the case after your marriage. You can take up a job in the corporate, but at least a few thousand like you are qualified to do that very same job, and any of them can contribute to the society through that job. But there is one task at home where you are irreplaceable, and that is to be the lady of the house, being a mother. Once when Swami was talking to students of a women's college in Bangalore, he said, nowadays the mother of the house appoints one person to cook for the children, one person to serve, one person to dress them up and put them to sleep. And that way, Swami said, she converts the home into a hotel. And I guess Swami is also saying that she makes the home a hotel and she herself becomes a manager of sorts. Swami would generally say this, though man has two hands, two legs, two ears, etc., etc., man is just not the combination of these limbs and organs. Similarly, though a mother is one who plays all these roles, a combination of as many people to play all these roles does not make motherhood. And if you take up a job, at best your contribution will be, say, 1 million rupees per year to the family income. Far, far greater than that would be if you can groom your children with all your time and attention, and at the end of your life you can say, I have contributed these 1, 2, or 3 good citizens to the society. There is no contribution or achievement greater than that. Keep that in mind always. So keep all of these things which I said in mind and forget about if you will get a job or not. If you get, good. If you really feel it is necessary for you to work, either for your own self-satisfaction or for the necessity of the family, fine. But remember, your greatest opportunity to contribute or make your life worthwhile is not confined to your career. In fact, your career plays a role far lesser important than you can imagine. So to quickly summarize, you don't have to worry if what you're going through is depression. So don't worry about your worry. It is only a temporary phase. If your parents are fine with it, you can take up a job. It will keep your mind occupied and that will surely help. Don't worry about having to quit your job. Every experience will enrich you. If not a job, try to volunteer somewhere. Doing seva is even better an option than a job. Or you could probably try to join some cookery classes. It would probably make your mother happy too. Keep this always in mind. As long as you use your life to make a difference in others' lives, enrich the life of others, your life will be well spent and you will feel fulfillment too. Swami would say, young people should have 6 qualities. Utsaham, sahasam, dairyam, buddhi, shakti, parakramam. Swami would say, in that the first two, utsaham and sahasam, means enthusiasm and adventurousness. So keep your mind in that state. Tell yourself, wherever Swami places me, I will make a difference to the lives of people around me. I will bring joy and meaning to people's lives. Have that confidence and look forward to life and the new experiences that are waiting to break into your life. Not just now, always. However challenging the coming times are going to be, I will face it and help those around me too. Have that feeling. Finally, taking up a job, having a career is only one small way of contributing to society and family. In fact, for a woman, a far greater way of contributing is when she gives the society noble sons and daughters. And that calls for enormous amounts of time, energy and involvement, which only you can give. In that particular job, if I can call it that, you are going to be irreplaceable. Keep all these points in mind and then make your decisions. Look forward to life like someone who is going to start a new adventure. And what more you're going to have? You're going to take on the adventure with Swami as your companion. It's going to be really, really exciting. So all the very best to you. Right then, with that, I will have to wrap this week's show with dear listeners. I thank the two listeners for their questions and thank each one of you for joining me today. It's always a pleasure to be with you on this program. If you have any questions or doubts or dilemmas about practical spirituality, about putting Swami's message into daily life, you'd like me to answer that question on this show, all you have to do is send me a mail with your question. And my mail ID is prem@radiosai.org. That's prem@radiosai.org. That's my personal mail ID. As I've said before, you don't have to worry that if anybody else will read your mails, it's going to be only me. I offer this humble effort at Swami's lotus feet. I'll meet you in a bit again on the afternoon satsang. I started today by talking about the inauguration of Swami's first mandir. I'm going to leave you with a couple of nostalgic melodies that used to be sung in Swami's presence in the days of the old mandir. Enjoy.